This is Not the Average Real Estate Podcast by Not Your Average Real Estate Investor. Dipna Boholt used real estate investing strategies to completely replace the income from her accountancy practice with passive income in just 18 months and has since taught thousands of others to do the same. Welcome to the I Love Real Estate Podcast.
Welcome back to I Love Real Estate and this special series that we're bringing to you, which is a summary and a replay of Conquer the Chaos. Now, you're receiving it in bite sizes and you're absolutely going to love our next episode. In this episode, Dipna starts with the time that you need to make available to invest in yourself. She also covers a really important model for you to look at. It's called the Four Futures Model. She's become famous in actually getting people to take action that's in their best interest, and she uses this model to show you exactly how important taking action today is for your future self. So that's really powerful stuff, but that's not all. It even gets better than that. So halfway through the episode, she talks about the timing of the market and the current cycle, and she starts now laying out that journey, and she gives you a specific date where you have this window of opportunity to build into and where the big crash is coming, and let me tell you, it's not anytime soon. You still have time. So you want to actually listen into this episode and see for yourself exactly how we build out these timing indicators that are enable us to better perform in the market right now and not listen to the narrative out there and stay above the noise. So I'm going to hand it over to Dipna. I hope you've been enjoying the series so far. Enjoy this session.
Okay, so I thought I'd start the afternoon session with a quote from this man, Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich. He says, "You are the master of your destiny. You can influence, direct, and control your own environment. You can make your life whatever you want it to be. You will only do what you see yourself doing." And the more you learn, the more you see other people doing things, the more that becomes your norm. Just in the chat room, who has read, I'll just bring it up in a minute, who has read Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill? Who's read that? Yep, no, a few of you, yes, no, some, yes, loved it, yes, all right. Well, I tell you what, that is a brilliant book to give to your children. If you haven't read it yourself, read it first and then give it to your kids, because it's jam-packed full of simple things that really put you on the right track for being successful, whether it's in business or whether it's in real estate or shares or anything else. So there's some really simple stuff. There's another book I probably should put up there as well that I think is great, particularly for young people, particularly for kids, is The Richest Man in Babylon by George Clason. There's from. So if you want to grab a couple of books while it's, you know, reading in bedtime, there's a couple of books that I think are worthwhile looking at. And I'll come back to Napoleon Hill in a minute. I was looking at some research the other day about time, because people always whinge that they haven't got enough time for this and enough time for that. We all have 168 hours in a week. Typically, we spend 56 hours sleeping. We spend 40 hours working. We spend 42 hours eating, commuting, family time, et cetera, et cetera. And we spend 30 hours, or we don't spend 30 hours, 30 hours is enough time for us to pursue our goals. That's what we have left over. And unfortunately, most people waste their 30 hours. You see, time is our most valuable asset. And it can either be your friend or it can be your foe. I just want to draw something on the board for you, which I think will help you before I give that book away. We come back over here. Let's bring that up a bit.
Can you unshare your screen, please?
Oh, I forgot. It's coming.
Thank you.
There we go. I want to share something with you here. That is, we talk about time. You know, and we sit here today, this is today, and time goes on. whether that's 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. Time just keeps rocking on. A lot of people, when, and I would call this the intro surfers. These are the people who pick up a bit here, whatever. They try things. They give it a go. These are the people that are negative gearing. They'll go like this. They'll give something a go and it might work. And then they get slack again, nothing happens. And then they give something else a go and it might work, might not, whatever. And they end up over here where they're really no better off. Notice I put these people in amber. Because they're trialing a few things, but they really haven't got a strategic plan in place. Then you've got those, and to put this in sporting terms, these are the guys that, you know, they go to social sport and they learn a few things along the way, but they really don't devote themselves to being the best or getting the best result. But worse still, you've got the guys that go like this. And these are the guys that drift. And in drift, drift always leads to crisis. Always, every time. Because these are the guys that do nothing. Now, if you do nothing in the property market, you're going to get left behind. You know, you can't save fast enough to keep up with the values of properties. You can't do it. Particularly in times when things start to take off, as I'm going to talk about in a minute. So these people are just drifting. A lot of these people, you know, will die renting. These people don't actively get out there to try and do things. They certainly wouldn't spend money on their education. They just drift. And then you've got those people up here who do succeed. And they go up here, and I'm going to put winning up here or winner. But what's the difference between these people? It's all those incremental decisions that are made along the way, every day, better decisions, better property deals, better strategies that give you that uplift. Now, when we talk about time, the thing is, the easiest place to jump lines is closer to today. You know, if you're on the amber or the red line, it is much easier for you to do it now rather than down the track, because the lines get harder and harder and harder to jump. And if you want to accelerate, you have to invest in yourself. Because these incremental decisions, a lot of those incremental decisions can be made through trial and error and other things. And you know, you learn a bit here and you learn a bit there. But if you want to accelerate that and go like this, that's where education comes into it. Because what education does, and then this is in any field, I'm obviously talking about real estate, but in any field, it's education that accelerates your progress. I remember years ago, I went to South America, and I didn't want to go on a, you know, I'd stay in hotels all the damn time. So I didn't want to do any of that. I wanted to go right out into the Amazon. And we did a whole South American thing. But one of the places that we went was we flew out of, can't remember now. Anyway, we flew out into the Amazon, and then we went on a boat trip for another, day and a half up the Amazon. It was ages and ages we went up the Amazon. And then we stayed at this research center. Now, the research center was very, very primitive. All the houses were on stilts off the ground like this. They had no walls. They just had a roof and a half wall and horsehair beds. And it was rough. Mosquito nets you had to tuck in underneath, otherwise the spiders crawled into bed with you, which was not very nice at all. And I remember my husband waking me up one night. He goes, "Mom, you gotta have a look at the wake up. We gotta have a look at the ceiling." And I look up the ceiling; it's full of fireflies. It was fireflies. It was just beautiful all over the ceiling. And these noises of the Amazon at night—they're loud and animals and all this stuff. Anyway, that's what I was talking about. What we did was we went to this really remote village that really didn't see white people at all. And we spent an afternoon with the chieftain, and apparently my husband's a pretty good with the blowpipe. I won't mention the fact that he wanted to keep Brian, and he offered him, you know, two of the women in the tribe to keep him because he'd be a good monkey hunter, apparently. But anyway, so we said to him, look, what can we do for you? You know, we can help you. What would you want? And this chieftain, who, you know, is running around practically the nud and all of this kind of stuff, in his really primitive understanding of life, he said, teach the kids. Because he knew, even in that, you know, without any influence from outside world or whatever, he knew there was education that would make his village be able to continue on. Because he knew that what was happening to them wasn't going to be sustainable. And it was about, you know, paying for a teacher and schools and books and whatever else. So education is the one thing that makes such a difference. The more you know about anything, the better decisions you will make and the better results you're going to get, which turns in real estate, we're talking about profit. So it just cuts across absolutely everything. Come back to my slides. There's another book by Napoleon Hill. It's called Outwitting the Devil. That's it there. Now, he wrote that book back in 1938, but it was never published because it was this conversation he was having with the devil, is the way the book was written. And his wife begged him not to publish the book in her lifetime. Well, she outlived him, and she made her daughter promise never to publish the book in the daughter's lifetime either. Because back then, talking to the devil, you know, they'd be outcast of society and all that sort of stuff. So it didn't ever get published. But when the daughter died in 2010, the Napoleon Hill Foundation contacted Sharon Lecter. Now, Sharon Lecter is the co-author of the Rich Dad Poor Dad series with Kiyosaki. It's interesting that everybody thinks it's Kiyosaki, but it's actually Sharon Lecter that wrote most of the book. And they had a big court case over it and whatever. And Sharon Lecter won, by the way. But the thing is, they contacted her to publish the book and to add modern commentary to it. So it's recently come out. It's come out in 2010. And one of the things in the book that I want to bring your attention to is a conversation. It's a question that Napoleon asks the devil. And he says, how do you get people to fail? And he says, the devil says, there are three things. You get people to drift. You get them to do it in a hypnotic rhythm. Now, that's the modern terminology for that is make a habit of it. Sitting on the comfy couch, doing nothing, being busy, running to sport, doing this, going to work, coming home, doing it again and again. And getting into this hypnotic rhythm of actually not getting ahead, not succeeding. And the third thing is let time pass. Isn't that amazing? Way back then in 1938, there are three things that make people fail. You get them to drift. You get them to do it in a hypnotic rhythm or habit, and you let time pass. And we're all guilty of that hypnotic rhythm of nothingness at some level, at some degree. Because it's very, very easy just to sit on the comfy couch and to get caught up in the busyness of life and never actually sit back and think about what you want and where you're heading and are you on track? Are you happy with your life? Is that what you want to be doing? You know, you're doing what you want to do for your life. You know, we're getting one crack at this time round. You got to make it count. And for a lot of people, you know, they never have that conversation with themselves and consequently never take action and never achieve the kind of life that they could achieve if they wanted to, if they thought about it, if they applied themselves, if they did what it took to make it happen. Drifting through life without aim or purpose is the cause of failure. I like that quote. I like it a lot. And it led me to do a little bit of research about just how much time do we have available. Now, when you start to have a look at time, the average person, the average Westerner, lives 28,835 days. Now, that's basically 78 point something years, okay? Now, when you allocate time as to what we actually do with that, some research done, and sleeping, we spend 8,477 days in our lifetime. Eating and drinking, 1,635 days. Working, 3,202 days. Commuting, 1,929 days. Doing housework and chores, my God, I don't spend this much, 1,576 days. Bathing and grooming, 671 days. Helping friends, 564 days. Commuting and, going to community activities and going to church, 720 days. You add all that up, it comes to 18,774 days, which means we only have 10,061 days left, the average person, to fulfill our dreams, live the kind of life that we want to live, see the places we want to see, be with the people we want to be with, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I took that further. I said, okay, if the average lifespan is 78 years, it's 78 point something, but let's just call it 78 years. And I divided that into quarters. Well, the first 19 and a half, we don't do very much. Then the next halfway point is 39 and 58.5. Now, you put yourself on that scale. You put yourself on the scale wherever you are at your age. And then we take that 10,000 days and we divide it across the four quarters. In each one of those quarters, we've only got 2,515 days to achieve our goal and live the kind of life that we want to live. That's not a lot. That's pretty sobering for me anyway, particularly because I'm getting to the other end. It's sobering. It's really sobering. And then you start taking into account how much time do we actually waste? Well, some recent research came out about Facebook and social media and how much time do we spend on social media? Well, a recent study shows that the average person spends 135 minutes a day on social media. That works out to 34.2 days a year, or 2,669 days in a lifetime. That is more than a quarter of the time that we have, more than what we have in each one of those quarters to actually live a life. So are you spending, you know, your life just on nothing, on nothingness, not actually getting ahead, not actually achieving or accomplishing or doing something, doing what you want, what gives you joy? Have you even asked yourself what gives you joy? Too many people, I'm afraid, fall into the drift of life, and it's not good. It's not good at all. And you need to get out of that habit if you actually want to start succeeding. Success is not a matter of chance. It is a matter of choice. You chose to be here. You chose to be on this call. You chose to stick with me for the day. You chose to learn something. And you've got choices to make from here on. Every choice that you make from this point forward will immediately put you where you're going to be in a year's time, 2 years' time, or 5 years' time economically, financially. So all those incremental little decisions that you make along the way that make that difference as to which line you end up on. But it's education that will accelerate you. So here's some more for you. Here's another bonus that I promised you. This is my Conquering the Chaos book, which is full of charts and all sorts of things that you're going to love and enjoy in there. And there are the QR codes and everything else to actually get it. Now, Michael, are those QR codes working?
I believe I'm going to put the link in the chat room as well. So yeah, if there's any issues with that QR code, just use the link and it will go both in the Facebook as well. Yep. I'm not too sure if that one is actually working, that one. Okay. I need to update it, but we'll have the link in the chat.
Very good. Thank you. No. All right. So let's get onto it. Let's talk about Australia. I can't say that this is what's happening in Australia, because what's happening in Sydney and Melbourne is not what's happening in Darwin or Alice Springs or Cairns or Townsville or Timbuktu, for that matter. You've actually got to look at particularly then the capital cities in isolation from the rest and then understand the basis of demand and supply in each of those areas, which is where grid variance comes into play. Now, I'm going to show you a headline, and I want you to tell me whether you think this headline is accurate or not. Now, this headline is a headline that appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald. Okay, so you've got to put your Sydney hat on when you're thinking about this headline. So here it is. Australia's house prices are among the world's highest. Now, I'm just going to put mine onto full screen here. Now I'll go into the chat room. Tell me if you think that is accurate or not. Tell me in the chat room, do you believe that that headline is accurate or not? Where are we? Whoa, gone right down to the bottom here. Hang on. I'm in the wrong spot. Okay, most people are saying, yes, they think it's accurate. Yes, yes, yes. All right, a few no's, mostly accurate. Okay, well, that headline was published in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 11th of January, 1992. Don't you wish you'd bought up all of Sydney in 1992? The median house price in New South Wales in 1992 was $178,000. 178 grand, you could have bought properties in and around Sydney. Now, the thing is, trying to time the market, I don't think is a good move. I think it's ludicrous. And I think you are much better to learn the strategies that make money for you regardless of the market. However, having said that, I will talk about timing and I will talk about where I think it's going to bottom out in this little period and where it's going to crash completely. And that's what I want to cover here now. But I do want you to remember that markets are cyclical and markets go in cycles. And this is just another part of that cycle. And every cycle that you can remember, you will know that on the other side, property prices rose and rose substantially. So you do not want to be missing out on what that means for you in this cycle or in this half of the cycle. It all comes down to that demand and supply. And all the fundamentals, like I've been talking about, are well and truly in the having upward pressure on house pricing, not downward pressure. Short term, maybe, but medium and long term, definitely not. Now, there's two types of economists. There's either the chartist or there's the fundamentalist. I'm a fundamentalist, and I think we've covered a lot of the fundamentals. I've got a few more to cover with you this afternoon, but we've covered most of the fundamentals when it starts to come to market cycles. But what we haven't covered are the charts. So just, I'm going to open up that chat room again. Oh, hang on. That's not what I meant to do. Doesn't matter. I'm going to open up the chat room, and I want you to tell me if you've heard of a man by the name of W.D. Gann. Who's heard of Gann? Give me a show of hands. Yep, nope, yep, no, 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 yes, yes, yes. Few of you have, few of you haven't. All right. Well, the reason I want to talk about Gann is because he's a very smart man. Now, he died back in 1958. Why are we still talking about him? Well, we're talking about him because he did a lot of work on charts, human psychology, and how markets respond. Now, he's mainly talking about the share market, but a lot of what he does overlay into the property market as well. So I want to talk about how he's been able to predict, or his charts have been able to predict, what's happening now in the property market and what has happened over the last 100 odd years here in Australia. Now, there's a man by the name of Fred Harrison. He wrote that book, The Boom and Bust of 2010, which in itself isn't particularly remarkable, other than the fact he wrote it in 2005. And he accurately predicted the bust in the the property market in the early 1990s. He predicted it in the 2008 through 2010. And it all comes down to cycles. He mainly talks about the UK market. But here's what it looks like. So in the study of market cycles over a long period of time, this 18-year cycle has five stages. And it's typically we've come off the bottom, we've bottomed out, we've stabilized, and then we go up for 7 years. That's called the recovery phase. Then something normally happens around psychology in the market, it happens around confidence, and we go into a lull. We might even go down for a period of time before we come up again. So we have this 1 or 2 years where we're just kind of in a little bit of a lull flux period. And then we have a 7 years of up. But all in all, those 2 7 years, including the bit in the middle, that's 14 years in total. Okay. Then we get up to the top of the market up here where we've oversupplied the market. That can never last in a true economy. So, of course, what then happens is it must crash. It normally takes about 2 years to crash and 2 years to stabilize, where the banks sell off all their foreclosed properties, etc., and then it starts to go back up again and we start the cycle again. So that's fundamentally the basis behind his theories. And he's traced this back in the UK for like 200 odd years. And then there's this other guy. Oh, sorry, that is American chart there. That actually shows you back to the 1800s how this 18-year cycle has actually been happening. So we've got basically 14 years of up with a wobble in the middle. We've got a 2-year crash, 2-year stabilize, and away we go again. That's just another picture of it going on from that period of time through to the 2008 crash. If we look at a few more charts, this one here shows you the chart from 1955 through to, you know, the bottoming out there in 1977. This one here was from 77 to 1993. Then we had 1993 to 2011, where it bottomed out and stabilized, etc. So you can see those charts. I'll just go back one. You can see, can't go back, no, rather way. You can see over all of those charts, over all of those years, how that cycle has pretty much gone in the same way. So now we move to this guy. His name's Phil Anderson. Now, he wrote that book, The Secret Life of Real Estate and Banking. I actually did an interview with Phil the other day, but years ago, back in 2013, I flew to London to interview Phil. And he talks about this 18-year cycle as well. He's actually come up with this 18-year clock, which I'll go through in a minute. And I wanted to talk to him about how the 18-year clock applied to Australia, and most particularly how it was going to affect us through the GFC was what I was talking about. Now, I've got a recording of that on my website somewhere, but I actually interviewed him just the other day, last week. And we were talking again about the same thing and how it applied to this part of the cycle. So anyway, here's his 18-year clock. Now you can see there, we're going to start at the middle of the clock here at 1 o'clock. So we've come off the bottom of a market and we're going up in that upward phase. So the first thing is we're ready for the next boom. Rents start to go up. So rents start to rise. Normally at this point in time, interest rates go down. Now interest rate is the biggest expense for an investor. So that means net rents actually go up, which is 3 o'clock. Now, because net rents rise, more people jump into property. So that increases the price of established buildings first. That's the first thing that goes up. Then because the price of established buildings start to go up, it's more profitable for builders to build. So 5 o'clock, builders start jumping in and start building more properties. 6 and 7 o'clock, they go crazy and we start building things all over the place. Then we have 8 and 9 o'clock. Now, in a normal cycle that is not tampered with by government, we would at this point have the banks going, here's some more money, everything's going well, have some more money, have some more money. We didn't get that in Australia in this cycle. And the reason for that is APRA. APRA saw what was happening in Sydney and Melbourne and says, we're going to get in here and we're going to fix it. But they ruined the country. You know, what they did in to quash the lending to stop Sydney and Melbourne continuing to take off, they killed the whole country. So you know, Townsville, who was going through floods and everything else, suffered just as much or more so because Sydney and Melbourne prices were going up. Wasn't happening up there. Wasn't happening in WA, although it did with the mining industry. But, you know, in places all around the rest of the country. Didn't happen in South Australia. It was only Sydney and Melbourne and a little bit in some of the capital cities. But the thing is, we quashed it completely. And I talked about that this morning. I don't need to rehash it. It makes me annoyed anyway. So we live in one of the most controlled banking systems in the world, if not the most controlled. Then we go to 10 o'clock. So that happened. They killed the economy. Yes, it went in a downturn. They realised they went too far. The Royal Commission, then that was a big nothing because they'd already killed the industry anyway by the time all of that came out. So now they're on bended knee going, please, 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 lend out some more money. 10 o'clock is the peak of the market at this point. So what we would have had more of a run-up, but we didn't. The peak of the market was scheduled to be in end of 2019. Now, we didn't get that because we stopped peaking at 2017. We went down to the halfway through 2019, and then we started to go up through 2020 into February 2020, and now, of course, we've had the crash or the COVID. So that's the mid-cycle slowdown in this economic clock. Then we go to the outside. So we get through that. We go through the outside. Land boom, world's tallest building, complaints about property tax, lavish government spending on public works. We're already starting to see this. We're starting to see massive infrastructure plans in the planning, rolling out to get people back into jobs on the other side of this. Real estate goes frantic and we peak. And then activity slackens, but confidence still remains high. That's when everyone's still saying jump into property. But of course, that's the peak of the market. And that's where we have oversupplied the market by this stage. We go into crash and burn. So that is the complete crash that we go through. It takes about a couple of years to completely bottom out. Then we'll have all the foreclosures, you know, stock market goes into a bear market, credit creation institutions stop lending out any money, the economy goes into stall, the banks start selling off all of their foreclosed properties, the wreckage is cleared away, stock market starts climbing, and then we're back into the inside of the clock again. Now, most of you who are old enough, and that would be pretty much everybody on this call, I would imagine, you will remember GFC, and you will remember what happened through 16 o'clock was 2008. That was the peak of GFC. And the peak before GFC, then we crashed and burned. It took to 2010 to bottom out. 2012 before we started to go again. All of that outside on the left-hand side of the clock is exactly how it played out. Now, I can remember, you know, a couple more cycles there and to what happened, particularly the cycle before this, the 18 years before that. I'm a little bit rusty on the one before that, but I still do remember some things. I certainly studied at uni and the like. But that is what has happened. So could we be governed by cycles? In another way, that's how that cycle looks. Could we be governed by this? Could this be something that keeps repeating over and over and over and over again? It's crazy if it is. When you look back in history, that's exactly what's happened, with the exception of World War II, where the period was not 18 years. And it's 18, a little bit above, a little bit below, but roughly 18 years. World War II, at the end of World War II, massive amounts of money were pumped back into the economy, and it ended up being a 25-year cycle in Australia for that period. Other than that, we look like this. So this last one, our that little bump that you see there in the middle, that was APRA. That was APRA getting in, meddling with what was going to happen. So you can see where the cycle would have gone had APRA not got its fingers in the pie. So let's have a look at the previous cycle, shall we? Here it is again. All right. So the peak of the cycle, a peak of the last cycle, complete cycle, was 2008. Okay. It took 2 years to crash, 2010. Bit of a leveling off, nothing. 2012 was stabilization period of time. And then that next cycle started again. So if we go back on that 18 years from the bottoming out and the stabilization, the 2012, makes the end of the last cycle to 1994. Okay, that's the end of the previous cycle. So that first period of time was to 2000 to 2001, and we did have a very nice run up through that period of time. Then we had the tech crash and a few other things, and that brought everything down for a while. Just a little bit of a bump, nothing much. And then we had that massive run up through to 2008. Now that's Australia, but it's also America and it's also the UK. So this is this just shows it in another way, that period of time that we're talking about, that 18-year cycle in that last one. So I've taken that again. Now, this is me just playing with charts a little bit here. So that's the same chart, just made smaller. So our peak is 2008. We bottomed out 2010, stabilized in 2012. So that was the end of it, 2012. Now I'm going to add that same chart at the end, and you can see what I've done there. So if we add 18 years to the peak of 2008, that means the peak of the next cycle is likely to be 2026. Now, the previous cycle, if I just add that last little bit on the bottom, started up in 1990. If we add 18 years to that, we get 2008. The bottom of the cycle, the one that we've just been through with GFC, was 2010, stabilizing in 2012, which means the bottom of the next cycle is likely to be 2028 through stabilizing through to 2030. The one before bottomed out 1992, stabilized out to 1994. Add 18 years to that, we get the bottom of that cycle. That's crazy. Absolutely crazy. And you can map it back and back and back. And other than World War II, which, as I said, it was 25 years, that's what's happened. So could we be governed by this, you know, cycle? Things happen for different reasons. GFC was a lending issue. The 1990s was the recession we all had to have. Mainly it was property and stocks started to get out of control. This one, it's a health crisis. Back in 1918, 1919, it was a health crisis again. You know, could all of these funny things that come into play mean that we run on this 18-year cycle? I don't think you can discount it. Now, I'm a fundamentalist. I'm not a chartist, but I tell you what, these charts have been like this for 100 years in this country, 200 years in the UK, 200 years in the US. But let's just look at that cycle that we went through, which we peaked in 2008. So back in 1994, which was the bottom of the previous cycle, the stabilization, a Sydney house you could buy for $194,000. That first run-up was 2001, okay? So that first run-up there was, you could buy a property, the median house price in Sydney was $364,000. And I've done three other cities there as well. I didn't do all because I couldn't fit them on the chart, but you can see where they are. The others were very, very similar. All the capital cities were similar. And then we go forward and we go, okay, so that puts us at this point here, okay? So we've had a nice run-up, we've had a dip, and now we're going to run again. So what happened then? Well, that next run-up, you can see, meant that the pricing in Sydney, that big run there, was a 48.8% increase. Melbourne was 51.5, Sydney, Brisbane was 61.9, and Perth was 68.5. That part of the run, that second half of the cycle, has always been, in every cycle in Australia, UK and the US, the second run of the cycle has always been greater than the first run of the cycle. Interesting, considering how much we've had in that first run. So by 2008, the median house price in Sydney was $542,000. Now, then we had a crash and a stabilise. Now, I know my chart says that that's level, but you can actually see across the board, by the time we stabilised, it had actually gone up a bit. Not a lot, but it had gone up a little bit. So let's work those figures forward. Let's say that our peak, if we add the 18 years from peak to peak, is now 2026. That's when the peak of this complete 18 cycle is going to happen. And we start to go, okay, well, we've got 2 years down to crash and burn. got a couple of years of stabilise. That puts us through before the next cycle takes off of 2030. Who knows what's going to cause that? But let's just say that the charts are right for the argument at the moment. Now, that means we started the bottom of this cycle as 2012. We peaked in 2008, we bottomed out 2010, and we really started to accelerate in 2012. Now, that also means that 2019 was when we were due to have a mid-cycle slowdown. We didn't get it in 2019 because, as I say, it's not exact science. We got it in 2020, just into the new year. So let's take then the, and we bottomed out there, we bottom out end of 2020 into the early part of 2020, I should say 21, not 01, 21, and off we go again. So if that were to be the case, okay, now the median house price in Sydney in 2012, as I had on the previous chart, was $575,000. The median house price at the end of 2019 was $1,142. It could have been higher if we didn't have APRA come in and squash things. So doesn't matter, that's what it was. Now, if we also then get the acceleration in this next half of the cycle at the same rates as we saw in the previous complete cycle up to 2008, that means in Sydney, as an example, that 48.8 on the 1.1 would give us a price in 2026 of 1.7 million. Melbourne, 1.36. Brisbane, 934, and Perth, 900. Who knows where it's going to be in 2030? But can you see? You cannot miss this next run. It's happened over and over and over again. And you don't want to be caught with your pants down not getting this biggest half of this complete cycle. Because every time the second part of the cycle, the growth has been greater than the first part of the cycle. And we've already seen significant increases across the board between 2012 and 2017, in our case, 17, thanks to APRA, but it could have been 19. Now, that second part of the cycle is likely to be bigger. These are just estimates. I'm not going to say they're right, they're wrong. But if the same happens this cycle as happened last cycle, that's what the figures are going to be. You have the ability to be able to double, if not treble, your wealth in the next few years. Now, you look at those figures and say, that's not double. It's not. But it's about leverage. Leverage makes the difference. Have a look at this. So that's the same figures that I've got up the top, right? Same figures, haven't changed them. And we buy a house in Sydney for $1,142. Okay, so that's the end of 2019 figures, right? But how much do we actually put in to buy that property? You see, we typically go and get an 80% loan and we put in the 20%. Well, 80% loan on that would be $913. We would be putting 20% of $228 in order to buy that property at the median price in Sydney, and all the other figures will be exactly the same. In Sydney at the end of 2019, just gone, right? So plus we've got a cost. Now, yes, we've got to pay stamp duty, other bits and pieces. So let's say our total input to buy that $1.1 million property is $277,000, okay? So if we go forward to 2026, that same property is now worth 1.7 almost. That is a gain of $557,000. But we only put in $276,000 in order to get that gain. Can you see where I'm talking about doubling? So what that means is that is a cash on cash return of 201%. And there's the formula as to how you work it out. Melbourne would be exactly the same at 200%, Brisbane would be 277%, and Perth would be 289%. Cash on cash return. Seriously, guys, you've got to be part of this, but not just on one property. See, if you implement a strategic plan, every property you buy puts you in a better position to get the next property. So if you act on this over the next period of time between now and 2026, you could be into 10, 20, maybe even 30 properties, where the earlier ones could be doubling their value. The lesser ones will be getting a lesser return if the same figures apply as applied in the last cycle. You can't miss out on that. Most people will buy one property and think, oh, wow, I've done really well. You know, look how much my property's gone up in value. But they don't realize the opportunity cost of what else they could have done. You know, not only income replacement and living the kind of life they want with their own time, but actually having a number of properties where the cash on cash return is doubling. This is where planning, you know, being logistical, having that plan in place that is right for you is so important. This is not haphazard. I am not trying to sell you a property. I am trying to get you to see that it's so important for you to step up. And now is the time to do that, because we won't have much time before we're into that next run. We won't have much time at all. And you need to be part of that, not just with one property and you go, wow, look what I did. No, with two or three or five or 10 that are getting, you know, cash on cash as return and positive cash flows, so the properties you're holding are recession proof. So by 2026, you're in a position where you are geared up but not used on positive cash flow properties. You probably now paid off your home loan. You've got no debt on your home. You know, you've got investment properties out there that are positive cash flow. You've got a few commercial by this stage. You've got plenty of residential, and you are in the position where you are cashed up. You have income replacement and you have geared up but not used. So if that crash happens somewhere between 26 and 28 and then stabilizes out to 2030, you're going to own half the goddamn country. Isn't that what you want? And even if it's not, it could be for your kids or your grandkids or your whatever. You know, it's about creating that legacy. And now's the time to be doing that. You cannot sit back and rest on your haunches. You can't do it.
Well, there you go. It doesn't get any more emphatic than that. What Dipna has laid out to you right here is an incredible window of opportunity from where we sit today to where we're likely to be in 6 years' time. Now, 6 years' time is a short period of time and it's a long period of time. And if you really embrace this education, if you are a member of the I Love Real Estate community, this is the sort of information that you get that most people are clueless to. This could be the first time you're hearing this type of level of cycle analysis, which means it gives you the unfair advantage once you own once you add strategies and tactics to the overall cycle. It's good to know where the economy is going from a real estate perspective, but if you can't take advantage or you make some dumb decisions through that cycle which slow you down and almost destroy you, it is just a shame that you cannot take advantage of this last step of the real estate and economic cycle going forward. So I hope you enjoyed that. We're getting to the tail end now of our Conquer the Chaos replay series. There is still time, depending on when you're listening to this, to experience one of these events live for yourself and really lay out exactly everything that Dipna covers through a live presentation. If you want to do that, you want to head over now immediately to iloverealestate.tv and see whether we've still got the live event going. And if we have, you could secure a ticket for free. It'll be the greatest investment in yourself that you can ever make, and it costs you nothing. So head over to I Love Real Estate TV, secure a free seat to Conquer the Chaos Live if we're still running it live. Outside of that, I hope you have an awesome day, and we're getting now to the home stretch of Conquer the Chaos series, the replay series. So that's all from me, John Gian. I will see you on the next episode. Bye from now.